Since 1898, Marquis Who's Who has offered our distinguished listees the opportunity to set themselves apart through our print publications. Now, Marquis Radio offers these illustrious professionals the opportunity to shine in our one-on-one interviews. My guest today is Jack Barkas, who is the Chair of Psychiatry and Psychiatrist-in-Chief at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Weill Cornell. How are you doing today, Dr. Barkas?
Very well. I very much appreciate the opportunity to be interviewed by you.
Why don't you start by telling us what you'd like to focus on for this interview segment?
I'd like to focus on my broad goal, which is to talk about the importance of mentoring and encouraging people in medicine at all steps, from the very beginners to senior persons, and helping those who do clinical work of all types, research, education, administration, community service, and public policy. Every role in medicine is important and makes a difference.
And how do you take an active role in mentoring?
Well, I happen to be a physician, a psychiatrist, a medical researcher, a teacher, and a chair of a department. And so I take mentoring very seriously. I think one has to listen to one's mentees. One has to try to help them figure out what it is they really want to do. The needs are different at different stages. So sometimes a high school student or a college student will approach me, and I'll encourage them to go ahead and try to get an opportunity to volunteer in one way or another in a clinic or in a lab, etc. In other situations, I'll be talking to somebody who is a medical student who's wondering about how to become a psychiatrist, or should they become a psychiatrist, and I'll urge them to get additional experiences so they can see if they really like the field. I happen to love it, and I hope that they will enjoy it whether they go into it or not, because most physicians, one way or another, actually are doing psychiatry, and probably 20-25% of the people they see actually have a psychiatric problem, no matter what medical problem they're approaching them with. And then I also deal with young faculty and trainees. And, of course, one of the most fascinating aspects of my job, and one I wasn't so aware of when I started, was the importance of mentoring senior people who often have fewer individuals they can get advice from. And just hearing them out, hearing what their current dreams are, thinking through issues of funding and things of that sort, and then trying to help them either to realize those or to move in new directions. And each of those activities is a very important type of thing. And oftentimes I'll even be dealing with people who aren't in medicine or interested in medicine, someone who's in law or accounting or something of that sort, who says, I'd like to do something for the mentally ill. How can I do it? And there are lots of ways. Institutions need good accountants. They need good lawyers. Similarly, there are people in other areas of medicine who say, gee, how could I go ahead and learn something that would make me more effective? I think I might prefer psychiatry to what I'm doing now, because psychiatry has become so exciting and interesting because of all the developments in the field. So those are all issues that come up in the type of life that I lead at this time, and something that I enjoy a great deal.
And is there a typical relationship that you try to cultivate between a mentor and a protege?
Yes. Oftentimes, what I'm really asked about is, hey, of the people in your department, is there somebody I should be trying to work with? And I happen to believe that the best thing you can do is hear out what the person's really interested in, and then say, gee, I have so-and-so and other people who might be able to be of interest to you. So I tell them a little bit about the different folks in the department. Sometimes I'll arrange a meeting between them. Other times I'll say, go ahead and give a call and use my name, et cetera, because that's a very, very important aspect of the entire process of growing into the field, and makes a very big difference.
So let's look at this from the other side of the equation. Why be a mentor?
It's extremely satisfying to be able to help other people as they develop their lives, no matter what stage they are at. I was helped even at the level of high school. I met some psychiatrists and had a lot of respect for them. They were interested in approaches that were not the approaches that I was personally after for myself, but they were very encouraging, very thoughtful. And being a mentor, you enable yourself to see the future and to help shape the future. And sometimes I've had people working with me who ended up being truly world class in one way or another. But a lot of times, they're people who are simply doing good and doing it very well. They're excellent at practice, or they're excellent as researchers, or in whatever way. And that's very, very satisfying. And some of those relationships can go on for many years. That's been a big surprise to me. I never expected that relationships could go on for decades. I myself was a mentee of a very great couple in psychiatry, David and Betty Hamburg at Stanford, when I first started there as a resident. And over the ensuing almost 50 years, they have become a hybrid of friend, family, intellectual companions, and they're probably my very best friends. So it's a remarkable thing to realize that a relationship like that can last so long. I had figured, okay, I'll know these people for a year or two or three and then move on. But a lot of times it doesn't go that way. And I've had mentees myself where the relationship has gone on already for decades. Very satisfying. And you get to know them at a very deep level and to feel you've had an impact. It's something that is very satisfying, and it's a great deal of fun. At the same time, one can be a tremendously effective mentor in just an interaction of a few minutes. I once asked the head of a major program at UCLA, which is one of the places I worked there as a high school student, but also in college, and I happened to ask the head of the program, what did he think I should do? And he gave me advice about going ahead and getting a further training in research, and suggested that I go into neurochemistry, and even suggested a specific place that I should do it at Yale. That whole interaction took about the same amount of time that it took to discuss it right now with you, and I ended up doing exactly what he suggested, and it led to a wonderful career. So I consider him one of my most important mentors, even though that interaction was just a few minutes.
So I want to go back a little bit to your mentioning of senior mentees. What do they want out of a mentor relationship, and who would you think would be the best type of mentor to provide that for them?
Oftentimes, they wouldn't really call it mentoring, but it sort of is. Let's say a senior professor has had a problem getting a grant or this or that. It's not always easy for them to figure out who they can tell about that problem. They may be a little embarrassed about it, or they may wonder what does it mean and how should they be shaping their career. And so what I'm doing, I wouldn't call it formally a mentor, but I would call it simply hearing them out, being an advisor, thinking through the problems, thinking through what the next step might be, and also finding out what their own hope is for the future. Sometimes their interests have changed. Sometimes the thing they should be doing is different than what they were doing. Maybe they should be doing more clinical work or more teaching or, in some cases, more research, or changing their entire focus. Sometimes they want to do writing, and they'd like to consider writing a book or whatever. And so that type of what I call mentoring is a matter of just patiently considering the individual and what their goals are and what they should be doing, or could some of the options they could be considering, trying to figure out what resources we might have that would help them to make whatever transition they've got to make, or would provide some funding on an interim basis so that they could get the data that would help them in a very difficult and almost impossible time in terms of grants. So that type of thing all can make a difference for people, and they can really appreciate it.
So what do you think makes a good mentor?
I think usually an ability to actually care about the people who you're trying to work with. I had asked a couple of chairs of departments of psychiatry of what do they think is the critical thing about being a chair of department and being successful. And one of them, Alan Schatzberg, who just recently stepped down as chair at Stanford after 18 very successful years, told me that he considers the key thing to be someone who loves his department or her department and enjoys it and likes the people and likes the goals that they as an institution have set up, etc. And other people have used similar expressions. You've got to actually care about it. It's more than an administrative position to be a chair or to be a mentor in any circumstance. To be a good mentor for young researchers, you've got to be a clear thinker. You've got to be able to actually know a lot so that you can help them figure out what is the best problem and what are the best approaches to it. You've got to be efficient and thoughtful about every aspect of what it is that they are doing.
Do you ever find it difficult to invest so much of yourself in the success of your mentee?
To be honest with you, no. I personally love it. I've liked every aspect of what I do. I spent many years at Stanford doing research and running a big lab, and that was great fun. At that point, my major activity was doing that, being a mentor, but doing some administration, etc., and that was great fun. At the same time, now I'm involved with a department that is one of the largest private psychiatric services in the country. It's the only psychiatric hospital in the United States, which, thanks to my incredible medical director, Phil Wellner, has achieved a status called plane tree status at the highest level. There are only 10 hospitals of all types in the world that have achieved that highest status for caring about patients and treating patients with respect in a very rigorous review process that they have. And we're the only psychiatric hospital in that group of 10 in the world. So that type of thing is just wonderfully satisfying, even though it is so dramatically different than the type of work that I was involved with earlier in my career.
Do you find it's more common for yourself to seek out people to mentor or for them to find you?
Both processes occur. I try to see a great many of my faculty in any given year and have a discussion, individual discussions with them. Before anyone is promoted, I'm meeting with them, etc., etc. But also for some younger faculty, some senior faculty, I'll see them much more frequently, and other people will simply seek me out. So I try to keep a very open door policy. I tell my assistants, who are just wonderful, to put, if a medical student calls and says he or she wants to meet with me, set it up immediately, because for medical students, time moves at a very fast pace. And so you want to strike whatever is an issue right at the point that it comes up.
And when it is you making the first move, how do you initiate that relationship?
Well, that's pretty straightforward. As a chair, I'm responsible for the faculty and their well-being, etc. So it's very straightforward for me to just say, gee, I'd love to see you at your convenience, etc. So there's no particular problem in that at all. And when I was a faculty member running a big research lab, again, that was very straightforward. It was something where you've got to pay real close attention to what's going on, know what's happening in terms of the lab, be able to think with them about what it is that's happening, etc. There are many different styles of people doing research. Some people will hand a young mentee a file and say, just do this however I've indicated in the file. Other people will say, like the great Julius Axelrod at the National Institutes of Health, who ended up receiving the Nobel Prize for discovering some of the basic aspects of drugs which are now used to treat depression, etc. He was in a situation where he would be following the people on a daily basis as to what was happening. He read very broadly, and he tried to think through what people were interested in. And he would say to somebody, "What is your biggest single interest?" And then he'd try to find a way for he and they to come to an agreement about what would be a good problem that they could both be involved with. When it's done with the sensitivity that he did it, he was getting 150% out of people of what they thought they were capable of. People were amazed at how much they accomplished under his brilliant leadership, but also his love and affection for them, and trying to, in every way, bring out the best in them. You've got to recognize that people are very different. Not all mentees are at the same level, and you've got to individualize and personalize it, etc.
So were there many other professionals in your field that take such an active role in mentorship?
I think a lot of them do. I think people who are in one way or another connected to academic institutions, either working with full-time faculty or voluntary faculty, take a lot of interest in helping young people and people at various stages. It's one of the magnificent things about this country is that we actually have very great institutions of higher learning, and in terms of medicine, just remarkably wonderful organizations. But we've got a lot of problems, and those include the fact that despite the fact that research and clinical activity are such an exciting phase right now, there are serious problems in terms of funding, etc., and how can we help with that withdrawal of funds, and which have resulted in the NIH budget effectively going down about 20% and scheduled to go down even further if the current proposals are invoked. At the same time, there is support in both legislative areas, the Senate and the Congress, of people. There are many people who recognize how important information and good clinical care and good research are for medicine and actually for our country. It's an important growth industry for our country, and our country has been a leader in it, and so that there is some support for it. And similarly, there are some very brave and wonderful foundations like the Brain and Behavior Foundation, with the active involvement of the Lieber family, who are the leading donors for mental health research in the world. And there are not only groups like the Liebers, but there are individuals such as the Pritzker family, initially led by Jay and Cindy Pritzker of the Hyatt Hotel, and now wonderfully led by Tom Pritzker, who made a bold and powerful decision to support fundamental and clinical research on depression in several closely related and connected institutions, including Stanford, Michigan, and Cornell. And they realize that we need both basic and translational and clinical research, and have been very important about it. The interesting thing is that the latest information from the World Health Organization is that the biggest causes of disability for people are actually mental health connected. Depression is one of the largest, if not the largest, and is a leading cause of death in young people, etc. Suicide rates are very high, as you know. So there is plenty of reason to believe that these types of areas are very, very important. And another problem facing the field is stigma and the lack of knowledge about mental disorders. And that's something that's very hard to overcome. And people like myself, who are in leadership positions, as well as people who are working at other levels, need to really fight against stigma. It's sort of funny, we talk these days a lot about the mentally ill and violence, but actually they don't seem to be creating much more violence than people without mental illness, and more often than not they are victims of violence rather than perpetrators of violence. But so that's a very important issue. The job of all of us is to try to help turn that around and try to make a difference in it. And so that I think can be done, but it's got to be done very, very thoughtfully.
And on the subject of funding, what can an individual do? And I'm speaking mainly of laymen here, but what can an individual do to help support your cause and help make sure that educational organizations receive the funds they need?
Well, one of the tragedies is that so few people have been committed to funding this. I'm of a generation where I can remember when if you had a member of your family with cancer, you didn't tell anybody about it because it was considered a deep, dark secret. And now people are very aware of the fact that we're making good progress on cancer and that people should support it through various mechanisms. Like in our case, it would be the Brain and Behavior Foundation, which is a national, actually an international funding agency that is concerned about very severe mental disorders. Also, if people have a connection to a particular medical school or college or university, it's always helpful to send a gift saying it's earmarked for research on mental illness or that might be relevant for mental illness and addictive disorders. Those types of things make a very real difference. Right now, the total number of people doing such support is extremely limited, even though the incidence of these disorders is as high as for heart disease and cancer, et cetera, and the tragedy in terms of the impacts on people's lives is every bit as big and as difficult. So I think that the other very important thing for us happens to be that we are very fortunate in that the leadership of both our medical school and our hospital is very positive about psychiatry. We happen to be one of the two or three best programs in psychiatry in the country. And the end result is that they are proud of the success and constantly encourage our department and its faculty, staff, and trainees. So we're very lucky that way, and that's not true everywhere.
So what can faculty members do to find mentees? I know as a head of the administration, as a psychiatrist in chief, it's very easy, but what would be your recommendation to lower-level staff who still want to contribute?
Oh, that's very straightforward. They all get a chance one way or another to meet with and give lectures to students and trainees. They have a chance to present the type of ideas and work that they do, and they can create an environment which makes it attractive to the student to work with the individual. I've had many people, when I was running a lab like the one at Stanford, I would give a lecture to a human biology class of undergraduates, and I inevitably got people coming up afterwards and saying, gee, Dr. Barkas, could I come think about working in your lab or whatever? And we would always try to be responsive to that type of thing. So it's not an impossible matter to be able to pull that off. Etc. And people are able to get trainees pretty directly. And of course, one of the wonderful things about medicine is that the whole field is moving ahead. That doesn't mean that we've got answers to everything. We still don't know how some of the drugs that are used to treat heart disease, even some aspects of digitalis, we don't understand yet. And we don't understand everything there is to know about diabetes. As a matter of fact, diabetes medical problem is very analogous to the problem we have with bipolar disorder. They're both chronic disorders where patients have to be treated for a big part of their lives. And if you stop treating them, they are in big trouble. And unfortunately, under some of the plans that are being advocated right now for decreasing expenditures, they're going to be people who literally are not going to be able to get the care that they need long term. So we need parity of funding so that Just as with diabetes, you can't desert the patient. That would be true in terms of bipolar disorder as well, which is, can be a tremendously upsetting economically, psychologically, and in every other way. Even though some people who have it have been very creative and have made wonderful contributions, but nevertheless, it can be a very, very difficult type of disease. So we've got to be concerned about issues like that, and that gets into this whole issue of being involved in healthcare policy. Regular faculty and as well as the leadership need to do everything they can to encourage policies that make sense and that will actually help people, etc. One other thing, you know, while you're asking about mentees, I'd like to just say a word about people from other cultures, since that seems to be a big issue these days and in public discussion, etc., and other backgrounds. When my mother turned 90, she lived a few days short of 99. I was the oldest of her eight children. I asked her what she had learned, and she said every group of people from every country and background have good people and bad people. Sometimes government or religious leaders can bring out the best or the worst, but always judge people as individuals, not as members of a group. Never discriminate. And by gosh, I have seen that in my own life. Time and time again, I've had people from all over the world of different backgrounds, different religions, different beliefs, etc., etc. And the people I've seen have been good people, wonderful people. A number of them have been immigrants. Some of them have been people who came to this country to study, expecting to go back to their home country. Many of them did. But others simply fell in love with this country and have stayed and helped this country while still caring about their home country. They are totally committed to America and believe in it and love it and are model citizens of this country. And I would say that we have been enriched by our immigrants to this country and very much helped by them. So I just follow my mother's advice, never discriminate, always work to bring out the best and most exciting in individuals, work to enable them to recognize and appreciate their own talents. And I would also say, in terms of mentees, that it's not always possible for either a mentee or a mentor to know what the future is going to hold. One can live many different types of lives and make difference in many different ways, and our lives can change. I love doing what I was doing at Stanford. It was a magnificent experience. My late wife developed a brain tumor, which she had for half the 36 years we were married. She ended up developing the field of social neuroscience and had a profound impact on me. But as her illness worsened and before her death, she was bedridden a great deal, and I had to take a different type of job. So I took a wonderful job at UCLA as an administrator, being a dean for neuroscience and then a dean for research in general. And I found talents that I hadn't really known I had and that I've enjoyed. So my advice to people is don't be afraid of change. You may find you've got new things you can do that are actually very satisfying. I've loved both parts of my life. And matter of fact, in this part of my life, I've found that I could help a lot of people in many, many ways. I had my seven brothers and sisters all helped me. My parents had been wonderful mentors and encouraged my interest. My son Isaac, who's an expert on development of high technology businesses, has exquisite judgment, highly relevant for my faculty. And I've now been married very happily for 20 years to a woman named Rosemary Stevens, who is a social historian of medicine, who was the chair of history of science at Penn and then the Dean of Arts and Sciences there, and she advises me on issues and alternative strategies, and it's extremely interesting because she thinks about it in a different way than I do, and so she's been a mentor in that sense to me, and she's just written a fabulously interesting book called Scandal Time, a fascinating history of the precursor to the Veterans Administration and the first scandal of the Harding administration in the 1920s. The first director went to prison, and so she's written this mystery, reads like a mystery. She's written five or six books before this, which are very serious scholarly tomes for which she won lots of awards. But here, her mystery was this man actually guilty of conspiracy? It's very timely to the facts we're facing with the VA. But she mentors me in the sense of just hearing out my problems and going through them with me and thinking about it. And I think that that's a very, very important type of thing to be able to do. It seems to me that there are many different sorts of things that one should be aware of. I've mentioned that business about not discriminating and not knowing what the possible things are in life. There's one thing that's very important, which we tend to think of in terms of young people, but I think it's very important for a mentor, a mentee, or a human being to continue thinking, reading, listening, dreaming, considering other approaches to a problem or a group of problems. Continue your education as self-education, even as you learn from others. That way you'll have a prepared mind for the next step and be ready to enjoy them and to move forward. Altogether, too often, lots of people don't do that. They stop reading, listening, and dreaming. And as a consequence, they're using their seed corn from years before, which may be useful, but doesn't allow the very best to come out from them. So I think that type of thing makes a real difference. There are other ways that one can learn as a mentor. I found that members of my staff, including administrative assistants, helped and identified issues, problems, solutions. I just had to listen to them and say, hey, what do you think about this? What do you think about this thing that I've just written? I've dictated a memo, and I'll say sometimes to my administrative assistant, does this make sense? And they'll give me advice about it. That's also, of course, really true of trainees and students. The trainees and students push you all the time. They push you in new directions, new ideas. They make your colleagues do that. Your collaborators do it. It's really what I enjoy about being in an educational environment, and you can be in that type of environment as a full-time faculty member or as a voluntary faculty member. And I've had friends who had similar experiences in thoughtful corporations and think tanks. And lastly, there's one other aspect about being a leader, so to speak. One tends to think about being a leader in a situation like I'm in, where I've got responsibility for hundreds and hundreds of staff and faculty and students and what have you, maybe 1,000 or so. But one can also be a leader by being in a community and leading a group, but you can also be a mentee or a mentor in solo practice of medicine by being the person who's kept up, knows stuff, and who other people turn to when they've got a problem and they need sound advice and judgment. And it's easy to forget the importance of exactly that latter type of leadership and mentorship and menteeship, because it's very important, but people aren't always aware that one can be a leader while being a leader of a very small group, mainly oneself, so to speak. And each one of those has some value and some things that are very important. You've sort of asked one way or another, if you could start your career over, what would you do differently? And I've loved every aspect of what I've done. I've enjoyed the work, the problems, the opportunities. I felt that it's really very important to be able to do them. And then it's remarkable to have an experience like this, which I never expected. The marquee people called me and said, hey, we've decided that you should be in this role, and we'd like to do a radio-type interview with you and what have you. So all sorts of things can happen that you don't expect, but one can derive tremendous pleasure without getting that type of formal recognition, which is a very significant type of thing to have happen and very exciting. But the it's something that is secondary to the inner satisfaction of just trying to do the job right and trying to help as many people as you possibly can. I have enjoyed my work on basic work on neurotransmitters, and including studying the fact that behavior and stress change brain chemistry, which may lead to new ways to diagnose and treat illness. I did some of the earliest work showing that melatonin might be a hormone. I didn't discover the hormone, but I did work showing it probably was a hormone and that it impacted sleep. I showed that I've enjoyed the fact that I trained people from all backgrounds in research and every discipline and worked at great places. And as I've told you, had tremendous, wonderful impacts from my own faculty. I've been involved in healthcare policy as it impacts clinical care, research, education, and communities because I was very active as a member of the National Academy of Medicine, sometimes called the Institute of Medicine, and was the first chair of its combined psychiatry neurology section. And I was chair of the board of directors of the New York Academy of Medicine, which is an organization very concerned about urban health, et cetera. All of these things are thrilling to do and to try to find ways to help people. And it seems to me that finding a way to help people is valuable. You don't have to be a doctor to help people. I love medicine because ultimately that it gets to that level in the sense that almost no day goes by that you can't help someone or help somebody else help someone. So that's very satisfying. But I think people can get that. There are a tremendous number of helping professions, not all of them labeled as helping professions, but most of us spend our lives one way or another helping other people. I had an electrical problem in my house the other day, and the electrician who came solved it brilliantly. I told him, hey, you'd have been a very good radiologist or heart doctor or whatever. And he said it gave him great satisfaction when somebody like myself calls up and say, hey, I've got a desperate problem. I don't know how to solve it. The thing isn't working correctly. And he comes over, and 20 minutes later, he's completely solved the problem. So there are a lot of ways to help human beings, and there's maybe more. These days, we're hearing a lot about how bad people are, but actually, there are a lot of tremendously wonderful people, and that's something that's very, very easy to forget. And being in a helping profession as I am really highlights that, but I would say it's something that's much more common, and every single level makes a difference. In a hospital, every job is important, whether you're the guy pushing people out in a wheelchair or you're the guy doing the brain surgery. Every one of those roles requires somebody who's thinking and trying to put the patient first, trying to help the patient. So I hope what I've done is to give you some sense of why at least this doctor loves being a physician and loves being involved in helping people and mentoring, etc.
Well, certainly. I mean, listening to you, it brings home how much we rely on each other as a community in order to succeed. It just reminds me of that old expression, no man is an island. And just hearing about your work and how you foster these relationships between people for mutual success. I mean, oftentimes we hear about being stuck in this crab mentality where we're all just crabs in a bucket, and instead of helping each other escape, we drag ourselves down and doom each other. But in your case, it's actually refreshing to hear putting so much emphasis on building strong ties and helping push each other up to the mutual success of everyone.
Well, I thank you for saying that. I must say you've actually completely captured by your questions and by this your summary what it is that I do and why I love it. So thank you. I appreciate having had a chance to do that because I don't actually often get a chance to do it in a way that goes forward quite like this. I guess I would just end by saying you're completely right. We're not an island, and I hope that we don't just as a nation let ourselves talk ourselves into a mentality where we stop recognizing the value and virtue of other human beings. And that's a very important thing to do. And as my mother, who was an optimist through her 99 years, she was a lady when she was about to pass away. I said, Mom, how do you feel about it all? And she said, well, I'll tell you, I was married to the man that I loved for my whole life, and we never had a problem. I have 8 children, and I'm on good relations with all 8. There's not a single one with whom I have an unresolved issue with either the child or their what they call their significant other. And she said, and I'm on good relations with all of my grandchildren and great-grandchildren. She said, so I'm ready to go whenever the time comes. I've lived a good life, and I'm optimistic. And she said, and how many people do you know who can say what I just said, that they've not got a single person with whom they've got a problem or an unresolved issue? And I think that is a marvelous thing. At the end of her life, she actually had pre-written individual letters to each of the 8 children expressing why it was that she particularly appreciated that particular child and what they had done and what they had meant to her, because they were all different. And I think there's more of that in the world than we're often willing to admit, as you sort of alluded to and stated so clearly and so beautifully. So I really do thank you for this wonderful opportunity, and I think you're fabulous as an interviewer and a good man.
Thank you, Dr. Barkas, for taking the time out of your day to share your story with our listeners. I want to thank everyone for tuning in to Marquee Radio. Stay tuned for more in-depth and informative interviews with professionals from all walks of life.